states this high valorization of art. He's, of course, claiming for himself as the artist an expert role against capitalist rationality, against bureaucracy, against the prosaic everyday. That's the model of aesthetic cognition being superior to conceptual knowledge. It's really the model to which much of the Frankfurt School itself is indebted, as we heard this morning. I want to question the claim that the aesthetic potential is a carrier of a revolutionary otherness. I quote Oscar Wilde from a magazine ad. Here we have Oscar Wilde's statement here, a generic conductor. It's from the First Interstate Bank of California. That is, the Interstate Bank of California is perfectly capable of claiming the aesthetic avant-garde as a legitimator of its own logic. That doesn't prove anything, but you can treat it perhaps as an allegory of the kinds of questions I want to raise today. I'll begin this talk about the routinization, Veralltäglichung, Weber's term, of charismatic modernism and the problem of postmodernity, with reference to a piece of literature which I treat as a very cogent analysis of the transformation of aesthetic culture and literary intellectuals at the beginning of the 20th century. Long before Thomas Mann leads Gustav von Aschenbach, whom I understand as a paradigmatic representative of authorship in the bourgeois 19th century, long before Thomas Mann leaves Gustav von Aschenbach to his death in Venice, symptoms crop up indicating that all is not well in hegemonic literary life. The novella, which many of you know, I hope, begins with an account of a frustrating writer's block. Aschenbach perceives his highly regulated routines to be increasingly restrictive, and the description of his background suggests a considerable degree of repression as the basis of what was then the successful authorial personality. More important, Aschenbach's writing itself registers its integration into the system of cultural and political authority in Wilhelmine Germany. The narrator of Death in Venice describes this model prose, in the following manner, I quote, "With time, an official note, something almost expository, crept into Gustav Aschenbach's method. His later style gave up the old sheer audacities, the fresh and subtle nuances. It became fixed and exemplary, conservative, formal, even formulated. Like Louis XIV, or as tradition has it of him, Aschenbach, as he went on in years, banished from his style every common word. It was at this time that the school authorities adopted selections from his works into their textbooks." End of quote. This account is not yet particularly critical of Aschenbach. On the contrary, the narrator at this point in the novella admires his ability to give expression to values of order, form, and stability, and only later begins to distance himself from Aschenbach when the writer loses himself in his Venetian escapades, exploring instinctual and aesthetic material inimical to established society. All this raises numerous critical, crucial issues, which I mention only to bracket them. The changing judgment of the narrative voice, the specific character of Aschenbach's crisis, and especially the question whether the real prose of Thomas Mann's Death in Venice somehow represents an alternative to the described prose of the fictional Aschenbach. Instead of pursuing these problems, however, I want to use this passage in order to introduce the problem of bureaucracy and culture. For although the narrator may, at this point, admire Aschenbach's success and, in particular, his appropriation by the cultural bureaucrats in the educational system, it is also evident that Mann includes this detail so as to point subtly to the ambiguity of the relationship between bureaucratic administration and cultural production. At least for the mind of an early 20th century modernist, Thomas Mann, it is not surprising that a writer whose works are applauded by bureaucrats may find his productive creativity stifled and may even be headed for a rather dramatic sort of breakdown. The notion that bureaucracy and aesthetic culture stand in an antithetical relationship to one another is by no means universal. In pre-modern societies, the continuity of literary life was one of the regular activities of members of the governmental or ecclesiastical bureaucracies. Yet it is equally certain that, to the extent that the process of Occidental modernization has been characterized by a separation of value spheres, the impingement of political authority on aesthetic autonomy is immediately understood to be a transgression against the fundamental organization of modern culture. When the American president gives his seal of approval to a popular film, or, to cite a more egregious and less exceptional case, the ongoing practice of censorship in Soviet-style societies, the autonomy of culture is wounded and can be condemned from the standpoint of an ideal, which is to say, never fully realized and completed modernity. This liberal line of thought, which presents the problem of bureaucracy and culture in terms of an insistence on the freedom of culture from political control, is both compelling and timely. It leads to a civil libertarian stance which no progressive political program can afford to surrender. Yet, as an analysis of the relationship between bureaucracy and culture, it does not go far enough, neither in 1985 nor even in 1911, the year of the publication of Death in Venice. Aschenbach's problem is certainly not censorship. He has no difficulty getting published. He does, however, have a problem writing, and as this far-sighted text suggests, that problem derives from a specific organization of the life world, an ethic of rationalized production that increasingly precludes the free reign of spontaneity. The paradigmatic author of the bourgeois 19th century is also a, quote, specialist without spirit, a centralist without heart. Trapped in an iron cage of capitalist productivism, he watches his literary powers dry up until he discovers a strange god, Weber would say new prophets, in the Dionysian dream that marks the end of Wilhelmine culture as well as the locus of aesthetic modernism. Again, I emphasize that the problem of bureaucracy and culture cannot afford to omit a thematization of efforts by political bureaucracies to administer culture in order to control it. A parallel problem concerns the control over aesthetic production exercised in terms of economic interest by bureaucratized culture industries. Yet the broader issue which I should like to address has to do with the transformation of aesthetic culture in the context of an everyday life increasingly shaped by bureaucracies of various sorts. The commonly held assumption that innovative aesthetic activity is or ought to be a carrier of an anti-bureaucratic potential must be scrutinized. Is aesthetic culture truly a genuinely oppositional alternative to bureaucratic administration? Or is the modernist attack on the pre-modernist culture of the 19th century somehow compatible with bureaucracy? Or polemically, does the avant-gardist, that is early 20th century avant-gardist attack on the traditional institution of art lead successfully to an aestheticization of everyday life, generating a life world that is particularly susceptible to bureaucratic control? I therefore link the problem of bureaucracy and culture to a reevaluation of modernism and its relationship to postmodernity. This discussion, in turn, raises questions about the changing status of literary intellectuals in the course of the 20th century and their attitudes toward hegemonic power. The practices of aesthetic modernism, which I equate with the historical avant-garde, at least claim to represent powerful alternatives to a purportedly desiccated culture of the 19th century bourgeoisie. Victorian Wilhelmine, the conservative 19th century. Aesthetic innovation promised to lead to profound social transformations, often described in explicitly emancipatory terms. The modernist vision of a cultural rejuvenation generated a specifically charismatic authority, and indeed one finds Weber himself, the seminal theoretician of bureaucracy and charisma, occasionally describing modernist literary figures like Stefan George as charismatic leaders. Charismatic modernism emerges, however, not simply as a critique of denigrated literary practices, although these are thematized as well, but as a critique of an everyday life that is experienced by intellectuals as repressively constraining. Before examining this phenomenon with specific reference to aesthetic culture and literary intellectuals, I want to point out a particularly convincing piece of evidence provided by Weber in a letter to his mother, which he wrote during a trip through England, Scotland, and Ireland in the summer of 1895. Weber describes an empty English countryside, the enclosure acts, urban industrialization, and capitalist modernization have led to the erosion of rural society. I quote, "Only here and there a castle in a park separated from a few tenant dwellings and a single barn, and occasionally a church from the 13th or 14th century among a dozen workers' huts rather than, as in the past, 50 to 60 peasant homes, too big for its congregation, like a suit on a consumptive." End of the quote. In the back of his mind is certainly the study of the East Elbian Latifundia, which he had recently prepared for the Verein für Sozialpolitik. His contention that the capitalist transformation of Prussian agriculture would undermine traditional social structures seemed to be confirmed by the underpopulation he encountered in England. This future shock and the subsequent sociological generalizations which anticipate D.H. Lawrence's mournful complaints regarding the passing away of merry old England lead into an account of a seemingly trivial event, Weber writes on to his mother. "By the way, even in Great Britain, the world is just a village. Can you believe that we met acquaintances from Berlin here? On the steamer to Loch Katrine, I suddenly saw, among the faces of those pushing to board with their sharp English mouths, Gierke's Germanic face of a bard, Bardengesicht. We traveled together to Loch Lomond, where our ways parted. Meeting compatriots is odd. We are otherwise so acclimatized that we have adopted the general whispering tone, pretend not to see the people sitting to our right and left, and only when asked do we give short and very polite answers. We always eat a little less than we would like, open our mouths as little as possible, and even when the stomach is audibly growling, we just splash around with our spoon in the soup as if we were not at all interested in the slop. But as soon as Germans were nearby, such a laughter arose among us when we were just waiting for the coach that all the English hurried over to see the barbarians, and I heard someone on the coach say, 'Merry Germany.' And before our departure, we had a lunch that the waiters won't soon forget. G, Gierke, started a meal like in the Teutoburger Forest, and I kept up. The confused waiters brought, as everything kept disappearing, ultimately superhuman quantities of roast beef, salmon, etc., probably fearing that we would otherwise start eating the guests. Three of them stood around our table, staring horrified at the destruction of their wares, and they were visibly relieved when the steamer tooted and put an end to the meal." Obviously, the alternative characterizations of English and German mannerisms have less to do with simplistic national stereotypes than with models of cultural historical practices. The same process of modernization that has unfolded in England and destroyed traditional agrarian culture leads to the restrictive codes of behavior in polite society. Against this modern present, Weber mobilizes images of immediate physical experience, the growling stomach, and an archaic past, barbarians, merry Germany, and the Teutoburger Forest. The encounter with the rationalized everyday life of capitalist society, which is England, which becomes particularly obvious to Weber in the foreign setting and on the eve of his nervous breakdown, leads him to conclusions not uncommon around 1900. The image of an idealized past is constructed in which fuller social relations prevailed, as well as an authentic aesthetic culture. Note how the calculating, sharp English mouths contrast with the poetic face of the bard of his German friend. This is certainly a typically modernist anti-modernism, a yearning for a pre-capitalist past that follows logically after the account of the English countryside. Yet it is also more. It is not essentially a yearning for pastness, but for a genuine community of pleasure, loyalty, and freedom, a charismatic community not encumbered with the restrictions of bourgeois civility. In the same year, 1895, that Weber traveled to England, Henry Adams visited France and made his first extensive study of Gothic architecture, leading in 1904 to the publication of Mont Saint-Michel and Chartres. Weber and Adams have a good deal in common. Both academics are concerned with cultural history and especially the construction of their respective national identities. Furthermore, both speculate on the cultural consequences of capitalist modernization, and both, in typically modernist fashion, elaborate charismatic alternatives to the reified culture of the late 19th century. This modernist turn is perhaps even more striking in the case of Adams, given his specific cultural context and his own youthful attraction to the Puritan revolutionary legacies of 18th century New England. Yet the scandal is there, a scandal at least from the standpoint of Boston Unitarianism, for the description of the cathedral at Chartres, the famous description of the cathedral at Chartres, is nothing less than a prayer to the Virgin, a celebration of an aestheticized religion of magical wealth and medieval pageantry fully foreign to the severity of the whitewashed churches of Lexington and Concord. I quote from Adams. Her great ceremonies were as splendid as her rank of queen in heaven and on earth required. And as her procession wound its way along the aisles, through the crowd of her subjects, up to the high altar, it was impossible then, and not altogether easy now, to resist the rapture of her radiant presence. Many a young person, and now and then one who is not in first youth, witnessing the sight in the religious atmosphere of such a church as this, without a suspicion of susceptibility, has suddenly seen what Paul saw on the road to Damascus, and has fallen on his face with the crowd, groveling at the foot of the cross, which for the first time in his life he feels. Like Weber with his Teutoburger Forest, Adams too appeals to images of archaic experience, medieval religion, in order to construct an alternative to the disappointments of capitalist rationality. In his prose, he repeatedly includes derisive jabs at practical Americans whose venal concerns make them immune to the forces that are fueling his own conversion. Adams' articulation of an archaic charisma in opposition to the legal rationality of the 19th century is particularly interesting because later, in his autobiography, he recounts an experience which indicates the specific relevance of this new experiential dimension to the 20th century. Furthermore, the setting is a decidedly modern one, the Hall of Machines of the Paris Exposition of 1900, and the chapter is symptomatically entitled The Dynamo and the Virgin. I quote again from Adams. But to Adams, who writes about himself in the third person, the dynamo became a symbol of infinity. As he grew accustomed to the great gallery of machines, he began to feel the 40-foot dynamos as a moral force, much as the early Christians felt the cross. The planet itself seemed less impressive in its old-fashioned, deliberate, annual, or daily revolution than this huge wheel, revolving within arm's length at some vertiginous speed, and barely murmuring, scarcely humming an audible warning to stand a hair's breadth further for respective power, while it would not wake the baby lying close against its frame. Before the end, one began to pray to it. Inherited instinct taught the natural expression of man before silent and infinite force. Among the thousand symbols of ultimate energy, the dynamo was not so human as some, but it was the most expressive. At Chartres, 5 years earlier, Adams had mobilized the past against the present, and in Paris he discovers the future. What past and future share is the experience of a mystical force that transcends what appear to be the limits of an individualist rationality and an ability to produce a community no longer organized in terms of market exchange. Be it the splendor of the Virgin or the radiance of electricity, a power emerges that seems irresistible, while promising to put an end to the greed, corruption, and decadence which, for Adams, had characterized American culture in recent decades. 2 points before proceeding. Weber and Adams articulate models of a new cultural legitimacy that shares a good deal with the full range of modernist programs that would prevail during the early 20th century. In addition to the ambivalence of an idealized traditionalism side by side with highly modern material, one notes, especially for Adams, the enthusiasm for technology that anticipates motifs of constructivism and futurism, especially in Marinetti, the insistence on sensuous immediacy, aesthetics, and experiential irrationality hostile to the logic of conceptual thought, which after this morning seems to be the key to the Frankfurt School, the valorization of collective identities, nations, the antipathy to established bourgeois culture, and especially the predominance of a rhetoric of religious grace, Adam's Virgin and Weber's New Prophets, perhaps also Benjamin's Messiah. One can consequently borrow from Weber's own categories and speak of a charismatic legitimacy of modernism opposed to the legal rationality of post-Enlightenment aesthetic culture. The charismatic character of modernism leads to considerably varied manifestations, but it nevertheless links together features as diverse as the divine voices at the conclusion of Eliot's The Wasteland, Lawrence's phallic mysticism, the revolutionary pretenses of the surrealists, Court Hill's activism, and the ambivalent collectivism at the end of Dubin's Berlin-Alexanderplatz. From this perspective, modernist culture, that is, early 20th century aesthetic innovative culture, seems to have an adversarial character to the extent that it protests and attempts to overcome the Protestant ethic of the capitalist 19th century. Clearly, this designation, adversarial, takes modernism on its own terms, for it perpetually staged itself as a culture of opposition. Although the subsequent partisan allegiances led to extraordinarily divergent commitments, Pound's fascism, Brecht's Marxism, Mann's humanism, the aesthetic critique of bourgeois society was generally intended as a part of a radical social transformation, hence the sympathy of many aesthetic avant-gardists for revolutionary politics. This is, of course, the point where neoconservatives attack the adversarial culture of modernism as the cause of the erosion of traditional values, as if other, social, and not merely aesthetic factors did not contribute to the contemporary legitimation deficits of the political and economic systems. Yet an alternative evaluation of the historical consequences of modernism is possible, the applicability of which to Henry Adams has been worked out in detail by Jackson Lears. Peter Bürger describes the project of the avant-garde as an effort to overcome the bourgeois separation of life and art in order to emancipate the values previously sequestered in aesthetic works, beauty and autonomy, and transfuse them into life. Adams is, therefore, a modernist insofar as his account of Gothic architecture does not restrict itself to aesthetic connoisseurship, but endeavors to produce an aesthetic lifestyle by describing an everyday life, initially of the Middle Ages, that has the character of a work of art. The same totalizing aesthetic religion is then modernized through an association with electricity and industrial modernization. In place of rationality, Adams invokes experience. In place of calculation, feeling. In place of practical utility, works of art. In addition to the bureaucratized political parties, Weber, in a striking parallel to Adams, calls for the charismatic president, I suppose the corollary to the Virgin. In place of industrial urbanization, Lawrence insists on Eros, as much as does his antagonist Eliot. And instead of exemplary prose for school texts, Aschenbach finds love, death, and Dionysus in a Venice that sounds curiously like Adam's Chartres and Weber's Teutoburger Forest. All these modernist gestures stage themselves as oppositional. Yet, and this is the alternative evaluation which I offer, it can be argued that they in fact contribute to the transition from the liberal industrial capitalism of the 19th century to the consumer societies and bureaucratized administrations of the present. For example, the vitalist emphasis on experience, as opposed to individual rationality, presented initially as an emancipatory strategy, has at least two unforeseen consequences. It paves the way for patterns of increased commodity consumption, no longer inhibited by the aestheticism of an earlier acquisitive individualism, Weber's sharp English mouths that have long since turned into acquiescent smiles in the wake of the modernist critique. And secondly, although modernism attacks 19th century individuality in the name of some desirable collective social forms, and the examples for this are legion, it fails to achieve that collective. The force of aesthetic innovation is not powerful enough to institute the intended social transformation, which is to say an unintended social transformation is enacted instead. This discrediting of 19th century rational individuality and inherited bourgeois social forms, one of the major cultural historical tasks of historical modernism, creates a social vacuum into which the administrative bureaucracy can expand. Despite the anti-capitalist and tendentially anti-bureaucratic strains within the avant-garde, that is, despite its own claims and the vernacular understanding of a fundamental opposition between bureaucracy and culture, its aesthetic revolutionism turns out to have itself contributed significantly to the expansion of bureaucratic power. Modernism and the avant-garde are not alone responsible for the disappearance of liberal bourgeois society. That sort of claim is made by neoconservatives, who, again, ignoring other changes in social organizations, economic structure, and political authority, are eager to blame intellectuals for a misleadership that allegedly generates a crisis of authority. But aesthetic modernism in the avant-garde certainly may have accelerated the process of social transformation, leading to the typical 20th century forms of administration. I want to flesh out this claim, the claim that modernist culture contributes to bureaucratic expansion, first by way of an analogy between two simultaneous early 20th century phenomena, the aesthetic avant-garde and the political avant-garde, that is, Leninism. That the latter, Leninism, ends up generating an extremely bureaucratic organization is indisputable. My argument, however, has nothing to do with the political loyalties of the aesthetic avant-garde, whether Brecht is really a communist or not, or with the aesthetic predilections of the political avant-garde, that is, what the Russian bureaucrats end up approving. Instead, I claim that both phenomena, aesthetic and political avant-gardism, operate in parallel vanguardist manners that are susceptible to processes of bureaucratization. Vanguardism, aesthetic and political, in the early 20th century displays three crucial features that influence the reorganization of everyday life. First, the invocation of crisis. Both vanguardist phenomena claim that established culture and society thrive on mechanisms that threaten to engender catastrophes. The Dadaists blame the First World War on bourgeois Philistinism, while the Leninists blame it on the bourgeois economy. On occasion, other crises are thematized. In any case, the result is the absolute priorization of the particular vanguardist program. Unless art, for the Dadaists, or the economy, for the Leninists, is revolutionized, Armageddon may follow. Second, cadre leadership. The aesthetic avant-gardists present themselves as a small group opposed to the masses of Philistines. The Leninists are counterposed to the merely trade unionist masses of workers. In both cases, the subaltern masses are described as venally materialist, while the self-appointed leaders, closet bureaucrats, present themselves as carriers of ideas, values, or theory. Three, life commitment. Aesthetic bohemianism is not restricted to the genuine loci of aesthetic production, that would be studios, theaters, writing desks. Rather, aesthetic bohemianism entails a lifestyle replete with fashions, demeanors, and places of sociability, coffee houses, communes, etc. The Leninist cadre member, subject to a perpetual party discipline, is constantly in the service of the revolutionary project, not unlike the Beamte in the German civil service. Because aesthetic and political vanguardism are full-time occupations, the elitist exclusivity is heightened. Most of the denigrated masses cannot participate, while the vanguardist stage is an exemplary lifestyle in which one value sphere, aesthetic or political, displaces a plurality of competing interests. By invoking an imminent crisis of extreme urgency, vanguardism generates a motive for bureaucratic administration. By legitimating the notion of a leadership cadre ontologically superior to the majority of the population, vanguardism produces the bureaucratic actors. And by insisting on the need to regulate all features of everyday life, the ineluctability of lifestyles, vanguardism describes the space in which bureaucratic control could operate. In the context of this paper, the analogy between aesthetic and political avant-garde serves solely as a heuristic device that leads to the recognition of an at least latent tendency toward a legitimation of bureaucracy in the culture of charismatic modernism. To understand the success of modernism in the West, however, it is crucial to hold on to both its adversarial promise that could appeal to bona fide emancipatory instincts in the recipients, and its affirmative function in the modernization of forms of authority and the transformation and the transition to the social structures of advanced capitalism. This double character of modernism, its promise and its co-optation, so to speak, is in turn subject to a historical dynamic that has rendered the oppositional claims of aesthetic innovation increasingly untenable. The obsolescence of the avant-garde, to quote the oft-quoted slogan, can only mean that the culture of charismatic modernism, the revolutionary claims that rung so true in 1920 for the Dadaists, has undergone a process of routinization leading to its integration into its erstwhile opponent, the bureaucratic administration of everyday life. This general process, the integration of the avant-garde, depends on several interrelated phenomena that await extensive study from the perspectives of various disciplinary orientations. I list some of the problems. the cultured middle-class public, the Bildungsbürgertum, against which historical modernism directed much of its rage, has ceased to function as a hegemonic carrier of taste. The force of the classical avant-gardist devices of shock and estrangement declines proportionally. Meanwhile, the residual popular culture from which modernism derives some of its forms has been displaced by industrially produced entertainment and the mass marketing of consumer goods. Every discotheque in the West, at least, promises an experience, quote-unquote, as overwhelming as Adam's encounters at Chartres. In fact, the descriptions of Chartres, the excitement of Dada's provocations, and Aschenbach's dream, all these modernist accounts of overpowering moments of sensuous aesthetic events that displaced the ratiocinative character of earlier liberal bourgeois culture, all those events provide the blueprints for contemporary mass entertainment. These transformations of both high and low culture reshaped the terrain on which the avant-garde could pursue its provocational strategies, and therefore contribute to the erosion of the adversarial claims. No shock provokes anymore, at least in the context of the institutionalized avant-garde. In addition, not only the aesthetic works of early 20th century modernism, but even contemporary works, characterized by formal innovation, have been fully integrated into the standard programs of university study. At the turn of the century, the background to the avant-gardist revolt, academic literature departments were still devoted largely to classical philology and rhetoric, or the elaboration of national literary identities with particular emphasis on medieval material. Precisely these areas have been marginalized within the universities by a revised canon emphasizing modernism. The burgeoning of Kafka research after the Second World War is a particularly salient case in point. Furthermore, despite the undoubtedly legitimate complaints of productive artists regarding a perpetual dearth of funds, one is struck, in fact, by the extent to which governmental agencies and especially established foundations subsidize contemporary aesthetic culture. The role of foundations in the establishment of a hegemonic modernist taste remains an especially crucial research problem. Finally, the expansion of the publishing and culture industries not only creates numerous managerial positions, but also ensures access to a mass market. Weber's charismatic artist George published his Blätter für die Kunst for an extremely circumscribed audience. Adam's study of Chartres first appeared in a private edition of 100 copies. The integration of aesthetic innovation into mainstream taste makes that sort of esotericism obsolete. Because of this multifaceted integration of aesthetic culture, the adversarial claims that marked the modernist self-understanding of artists and literary intellectuals hardly continued to seem convincing. Against this background, the debate on postmodernity arises, once the charismatic legitimacy of modernism has been routinized and appropriated by hegemonic institutions. The ambivalence of postmodernity, the simultaneity of radical gestures and a conformist celebration of social power, exposes the contradictory double character inherent in the historical avant-garde, while at the same time echoing the rhetoric of neoconservatism with its attack on bureaucracy in the name of the state. The contemporary cultural situation is defined, at least in part, by a critique of authority designed to stabilize authority. Culture as the purported antagonist of bureaucracy becomes bureaucracy's best alibi, as two examples from two very different realms of aesthetic practice can demonstrate. One of the influential new literary critical modes, Rezeptionsästhetik, or reader response theory, appears particularly well suited to call into question the legitimacy of traditional interpretations and, by extension, the authority of all established critical judgments. Precisely this relativistic potential has led conservative traditionalist critics to denounce it in the name of the determinate meanings of texts. Yet as Stanley Fish, one of the leading reader response advocates, repeatedly insists, the result of Rezeptionsästhetik, or the result of reader response criticism, is not a dissolution of critical or textual authority, but a recognition of the constant, quote, authority of interpretive communities, his subtitle, that is, established university critics. Because, I quote from Fish, interpreters act as extensions of an institutional community, solipsism and relativism are removed as fears because they are not possible modes of being. That is to say, the condition required for someone to be a solipsist or relativist, the condition of being independent of institutional assumptions and free to originate one's own purposes and goals, could never be realized, and therefore there is no point in trying to guard against it. End of the quote. No interpretation is permanent, but every interpretation must respond to established norms, because an autonomy outside of established norms is inconceivable, at least to Fish. Scholarship consequently loses any cognitive importance, it is not concerned with knowledge as an approximation of truth, and becomes a matter of performative capacity designed to persuade the intra-institutional interlocutors in the interpretive game. Fish's anti-traditionalism turns into a cynical defense of established criticism simply as established. The authority that once adhered to innovative modernism is transferred to the critical guardians of culture within the academic literary institutions. This same dialectic turns up again, unexpectedly enough, in the current film to which I referred obliquely as the object of presidential approval in the United States, Stallone's Rambo. I'll spare you an extensive discussion of the plot or the ideological ramifications in the context of a recrudescent nationalism. Suffice it to point out that in addition to Rambo's victories over scores of Vietnamese and Russian soldiers, all poor shots, the film enacts a struggle between the soldier hero and the military bureaucrat. For it was, after all, the military bureaucrats who tied the hands of the front soldiers who, left on their own, would have won the war in Vietnam. Rambo promises to, quote, get, end quote, the bureaucrat who betrayed him. Yet at the film's conclusion, when Rambo can in fact get his antagonist, he refuses to do so. In the course of the film, a nationalist belligerence has been mobilized, fueled in part by anti-bureaucratic resentment, and the war fever to which the film contributes will provide ample opportunities for the maligned military bureaucracy to assert the, quote, authority of military communities, end quote, if I may adjust Fish's phrase appropriately. The film not only demonstrates the re-legitimation of bureaucracy via a coarse critique of bureaucracy, it also displays the vicissitudes of the counterculture of the 60s, which in many ways was heir to the adversarial culture of modernism. Rambo is endowed with all the emblemata of a hippie. His hair is long and he wears a headband. He distrusts technology as much as artificial food. He fights in the battlefield without any cumbersome ideological apparatus, and he declares that he does it all only for love, for apparently love is all one ever really needs. Stallone transforms the counterculture hero, so to speak, into a contra, and this inversion is implicated in the dialect of aesthetic culture and bureaucratic authority. As the duplicity of the aesthetic-cultural opposition to bureaucracy becomes increasingly evident after the institutionalization of modernism, certain consequences follow for literary intellectuals. All of these consequences are hallmarks of the postmodernist situation. The implausibility of the adversarial stance leads to a phenomenon that has been addressed as the disappearance of the author. In terms of public life, this means the gradual retreat of authors from regular intervention in political debates. In Germany, a continuity exists or existed between the politicization of literature in the Weimar Republic and the activist stance adopted by authors during the 60s. With the death of Heinrich Böll, that tradition may have come to an end. This is not to say that all authors or literary texts lose political significance, but that the role of a major author as a public conscience of the nation no longer seems desirable or even credible. A similar caesura may have been marked in France by Foucault's death. One formal corollary to the disappearance of the author is the critique of narrative. Early 20th century modernism made various attempts to reinvigorate the narrative, Lukács' theory of the novel or Benjamin's elaborations on the problems of Erzählen. Postmodernist taste is marked by considerable suspicion of narrative literature, and especially film, which is denounced as authoritarian and or patriarchal. The critique of narrative merges with the valorization of deconstructive readings the insistence on the so-called self-subversion of meanings and the impossibility of consensual communication. Literary life is consequently asked to surrender its historical role as a medium of cognition and critique of social experience. This critical paradigm shift is lodged, surely enough, in a panoply of radical gestures, but at the same time, all discussions of emancipation are prohibited as vestiges of an anachronistic Western metaphysics. This termination of the cognitive function of aesthetic culture is one consequence of modernist iconoclasm. It also deprives the administrative bureaucracies of one of its erstwhile checks and balances. Meanwhile, the successful completion of the modernist attack on traditional culture renders modernism obsolete, or at least puts an end to a heroic phase. It survives only in the studied heteromorphism, as the saying goes, of institutionalized, that is to say, university culture. Finally, the experiential models of historical modernism have generated the patterns of mass marketing and consumerist behavior. The surrealist interludes in television advertising, the cruel theater of music videos, the ubiquity of Muzak, and the proliferation of lifestyles add up to a seamless aestheticization of everyday life. The avant-garde has finally won. Yet precisely this ubiquitous aestheticization of everyday life is the point at which considerations of a potential opposition to bureaucratic control could begin. Not that culture is to be again invoked as the emancipatory alternative because of a particular substance, the aesthetic experience, opposed to bureaucratic regulation. The aestheticization of everyday life has both distributed culture and secularized it, robbing it of its pomposity, Adam's Schadfe, while making it universally accessible. In addition to the culture of the university mandarins and official museums, the institutionalized neo-avant-garde and pop culture products, culture gradually takes on the form of an endless collection of signs of identity and authority that may be available for political formation outside of the bureaucracy, may be. Such an aesthetic of the everyday would have to take the form of a parodic inversion of consumerist material without falling into the trap of repeating it or allowing the bureaucracy to neutralize it in characteristic fashion, co-opting culture by labeling it as culture and therefore fair game for control. However, that sort of solution, a radical aesthetic of the everyday, is probably no solution at all. At best, it could lead to the marginalized practices of an anarcho-situationism or the neo-counterculture of the German alternatives. To the extent that they are not repressed or co-opted by state bureaucracies, they easily fall prey to the subculture apparatchiks, Leninists and otherwise, who are always ready to turn spontaneity into organization. Is there then no way out of the alliance of bureaucracy and culture? Or can one describe sorts of cultural practice that would operate outside of bureaucratic administration? I take these to be the crucial questions of the conference, and I therefore conclude with a reformulation of some of the preceding comments on modernism in order to underscore the challenge of the contemporary cultural situation. The significance and legacy of cultural modernism can best be understood if it is located in relation to both the pre-modernist culture of the 19th century and to the issues grouped today around the theme of postmodernism. These three cultural programs, Bruegel would say institutions, the pre-modernism of bourgeois realism, etc., the modernism or avant-gardism of the first half of the 20th century, and contemporary postmodernism, correspond to three distinct political economic formations: laissez-faire capitalism, in which market exchange organizes social interaction relatively independent of political intervention on the part of the liberal state. Secondly, the transition phase to modern administered societies marked by Keynesian and other forms of economic regulation carried out by an expansive bureaucratic apparatus. That's the sidekick to aesthetic modernism. Third, the current efforts to deregulate economic activity, dismantle the welfare state, and generally diminish the role of governmental activism in civil society. The relationships between the three cultural programs and the corresponding political economic formations are complex and multifold. A thorough discussion would have to examine issues of social composition, for example, the entrepreneurial bourgeoisie and the vicissitudes of the 19th century salon. A thorough discussion would also look at structural homologies between social organization and aesthetic features. For example, the demise of the individualist genre par excellence, the Bildungsroman, in the collectivism of the welfare state. Lucian Goldman, I'm sure you know, has written on that. A third kind of area of examination would be functional connections between aesthetic programs and social transformations. For example, the process by which the aesthetic avant-garde attacks the 19th century bourgeoisie and thereby contributes to the emergence of bureaucratic administrations, or, to cite another example in which the relationship is reversed and social transformation generates an alternative aesthetic program, the delegitimation of Eurocentric cultural traditions in the wake of decolonization as the precondition for the stylistic exoticism and historical eclecticism of postmodern art. Obviously, these points of intersection between cultural programs and political economic formations by no means exhaust the issue at stake. I present them in order to outline a full project in which social composition, structural homologies, and functionality would have to be addressed for pre-modernist, modernist, and post-modernist culture. In addition, by setting these three cultural phases in relation to three stages of capitalist modernization, liberal market capitalism, welfare state bureaucracy, and the contemporary critique of the administrative state, one can begin to locate the features of a critical discussion of contemporary logic that is not trapped in the logic, the critical discussion of contemporary culture that is not trapped in the logic of an obsolete avant-gardism or tied to anachronistic projects of engagement. Nor should this discussion, for a contemporary program for culture, I suppose, be satisfied with the transporting the categories of bureaucratic administration into aesthetics by insisting on, for example, a new canon organized around the objects of welfare state control, minorities and women, just as it must clearly avoid the traditionalism by fiat advocated by the neoconservatives. For what traditionalism is legitimate after the thorough destruction of tradition? Neoconservative and neoliberal critiques of the welfare state, as well as, on the left, the attacks on the state bureaucracy emanating from the new social movements, share crucial motifs, no matter how their respective political values may vary. All valorize a deflation of the state and a deregulation of different areas of civil society, and this chorus of opposition testifies to real processes that have eroded the legitimacy of the model of administrative expansion. This rejection of bureaucracy has even made its way thematically into the cultural sphere. Recall the examples from academic criticism and popular film. Both the neoconservatives and the new social movements have, in addition to their critiques of the state, their respective cultural programs. These, however, are less interesting than the repetition of the anti-bureaucratic discourse of deregulation within the postmodernist cultural programs in terms like polyphony, heteroglossia, the mixture of high and low forms, eclecticism, etc. No matter how postmodernist works may differ from the traditionalist canon advocated by neoconservatives, and they certainly differ largely, these same postmodern works in fact reproduce neoconservative values, beginning with their shared hostility to the revolutionary experimentalism of historical modernism. The aesthetic cultural corollary to the contemporary crisis of welfare state capitalism can lead, as I have tried to show, to the authoritarian cynicism of Fish, the culture industrial duplicity of Rambo, or to the confluence of neoconservatism and postmodernism. Can it lead elsewhere? Is there a progressive solution to the question of culture after bureaucratic capitalism? Modernist art, despite and because of its adversarial claims, found its home in the enclaves of museums. By suppressing any adversarial claims, postmodern art thrives on a reinvigorated art market, as if the deregulation of culture could only mean a return to market exchange and an intensified commodification of art. Can the critique of the welfare state be appropriated with an emancipatory intent and lead to other solutions? After administrative capitalism, a deregulation of culture could imply a breakup of culture industry monopolies, a decentralization of cultural production, including the invigoration of regional and local arenas, and broaden popular access to cultural institutions. In addition, to the extent that bureaucratic capitalism and the aestheticization of everyday life, meaning both the culture industry and commodity aesthetics, have gone hand in hand, a critique of bureaucracy could imply a vernacular de-aestheticization as a corollary to deregulation, community control of public advertising, workplace and consumer control of aesthetic settings, authentic public debates on matters of urban development and architecture. Finally, postmodernist insistence on mixing high and low forms, which corresponds to the neoconservative anti-intellectualism, has regularly led to the integration of popular material into the art market as commodified material, for example, graffiti art. Alternatively, popular forms could be re-legitimized outside of the culture industry and outside of the market. This last case makes the crux of the question clear. Affirmative versions of the critique of the bureaucratic state advocate a return to the market principle. The terms of postmodernism are not only structurally homologous to this neoconservatism, postmodern aesthetics corresponds directly to this program insofar as it, postmodern art, emerges simultaneously with large-scale corporate investment in art. If a critical alternative to the conservative critique of bureaucracy is to develop, then it must articulate its own alternative to the state and to the market as well. An aesthetic corollary to that yet-to-be-articulated critical alternative would have to describe cultural practices outside the state and its buttresses, the museums, universities, and the culture industry, and outside the market, too. If it is difficult to imagine a place for culture in local communities or civil society, then we have another piece of evidence indicating the degree to which our experience and our thinking are still caught in the categories of bureaucratic culture. Thank you.